You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 15th of March 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com. Because we have with us tonight the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door, and the Freemasonic Victory of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, how are you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right. I went absolutely out of leave last week when I'm back in the bunker now.
Yes. Well, we did actually manage to get an interview with Peter Rushton to cover while you weren't here, which I do recommend people check out. I think that was a really interesting interview, actually, talking all about MI5 and the way that they were following the early British nationalists around. So do mm-hmm. check that out. But we got some fantastic stuff for listeners tonight, I think, as well, Dennis, in particular. And it's all to do with your research for Part 19, isn't it? Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we get into it?
Yeah, well, I just stumbled on this just by pure accident. I was going through the New York Times actually printed the speech of Samuel Altemeyer. This is the guy who came back from international jury meeting abroad, said Hitler had to stand down, put all the communists and Jews back in power. And when Hitler didn't, and Germany obviously followed Hitler's suit, he declared a holy war. And as I was going through the speech, I just noticed that he was particularly having a go at the Jewish bankers. And what he was actually saying was he was criticising them for funding Hitler. This is 1933, so I'm guessing this is the first time ever that this has been mentioned. And what the situation was, in the Weimar Republic, when the reparations were handed down, it's like 600 million thousand, the Weimar borrowed the money from the Jewish bankers in America. Of course, this is a nice payday as well. They'll send them the reparation money and they'll take the cut. Well, apparently, when Hitler came to power, there wasn't an enemy of state or anything like that. So the bankers, in their eternal greed, I suppose, continued to get the cut by sending Hitler their payments for reparations. But Altemeyer found out that Hitler wasn't paying any. And so all these millions that were going to Germany, obviously, was most grateful for. But in essence, Altemeyer obviously cracked up because don't you realise you were funding Hitler? And I just thought a little amazing piece which had escaped me.
So he was using that to help rebuild Germany.
I'm sure he was.
pretty clever man. And I know you've been digging into all sorts for Part 19, haven't you? Particularly Heinrich Himmler, which we're going to get into tonight.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that before we get into it?
Well, the reason I just went to start off with Himmler was that he's the poster boy, obviously, for all the pagans who believe that National Socialism was not Christian but was paganism. There's some intrusive elements of that, but the overall majority, as what we're going to show in this video and previous ones, is that Christianity, or rather the Bible, was at war with the Talmud. Simple as that, really.
Yeah, I think that sums it up really. The Bible at war with the Talmud, because Christianity, yep. you've got Protestantism, you've got Catholicism, you've got clericalism, you've got the traditional church. But that's what it boils down to really is the Bible, and people who hold to that more than anything else against people mm-hmm. that hold to the Talmud. And you've been kind enough to furnish me with the script for it. Basically, yep. the provisional script for it. So we're going to go through that and we're going to elaborate on things from these quotes that we've got here. And the first one, I think this is one that we actually used last week or in the last episode. And this is from Franz von Papen, Chancellor of Germany.
You won't look at that. To be honest, I already had it down, but yeah, it's a fair place, a great quote.
And he was one of the guys that signed the Concordat, wasn't he?
Instrumentally signing it, yeah.
Yeah, and he said the Third Reich is the first power which not only recognises but puts into practice the principles of the papacy. He said that in 1932. Correct. And what he meant by that was getting rid of usury, removing Jews from public office, preventing Jews from marrying Christians, putting Jews in their own separate area. All these things that we're told Hitler did that were so terrible was basically just what the Catholic Church had been doing for the last almost 2,000 years, which yeah. only stopped, I guess, about the time of the French Revolution. I guess they sort of stopped what the church was doing.
Well, they were still doing a bit after that, weren't they?
Yeah, when was it that the Second Reich finished? I think it was 1800 and something, wasn't it?
1806, if I'm right.
1806. Because this is what a lot of people miss as well. I mean, the Third Reich, what it meant was the Third Holy Roman Empire. Holy.
That's right.
Being the important word in that. It was Christian. It wasn't mm-hmm. pagan. Well, let's have a look at these quotes that we've got from Himmler. This is the first one. And this is from Die Schutzstaffel aus Anti-Bolshevismus Kampforganisation, the SS as an anti-Bolshevik fighting organisation. And Himmler says, in this, obeying unalterable laws are included the sacred belief of our ancestors that everything on this earth was created by God and inspired by God. Only foolish, malicious and stupid people created this pagan fable, the horror stories, that our ancestors worshipped gods and trees. No, they were convinced in God's ancient knowledge and ancient teachings of his divine order of this world, wherein we were created in his image and where the plant and the animal world coexist. This is something that, you know, I've been saying for quite a while. The idea that our ancestors would have worshipped the sun or worshipped idols, I mean, they just weren't that stupid. They knew that the sun didn't give us life. There was something beyond that. And if you look at the Druids, mm-hmm. the Druids refused to worship Caesar. They refused to worship the Roman gods. They just thought all of that was beneath them. And I dare say the Saxons probably did as well. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of these barbarians. I mean, the Romans banned Druidry and they banned Christianity. You know, so there's obviously yeah. a link between the two of them. But this idea that we would worship inanimate objects, you know, that's always seemed a little bit silly to me. I like Himmler was saying here, they could see that God had created all of this. So why would you then worship something that he had created? And it's that same mentality that says, why would you worship Caesar? Why would you worship a man? You want to worship God that created the man.
The greater being, yeah.
Yeah, and when you look at sun worship, it's always associated with non-white races. And a lot of the time, it's also associated with cannibalism and human sacrifice, if you look in South America. And that wasn't what our ancestors were doing. The sun was a symbol for life or a symbol for God, and particularly the black sun. Because that was saying that this is spiritual light. This is the God is like a sun that we cannot see, that is far more powerful than our material sun that we need to give us life. And you know, the real sun, the sun that we look at, that's like a shadow of the black sun. It's like a shadow of the force that gives us life. So it's good to have this quote here. Did you have a look into anything else that was in this book, Dennis?
Well, no, what I did look into was the fact about that the National Socialists believed Jesus was not a Jew. I've come to the conclusion that World War II, again, being a holy war, was the nations of the Canaanites, the Edomites, and the Khazars actually, you know, killing and, you know, maiming civilians of the House of Judah.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's the way that I tend to view history as well. And we'll get into that a little bit later on. And there were people that were starting to understand that around about this time. I've got a book from, I can't actually remember the exact date. It might be 1943 or it might be 1934. And mm-hmm. it's a book called Tracing Our Ancestors. And in it, it says the Jews are descended from the Edomites. That's written about by Flavius Josephus. It's in the Jewish Encyclopedia. So that means that they are Canaanites. And then he says, and what will Hitler's response to this be now that this information is out there? And what he meant by that was, will they admit that they got it wrong when they were saying that the Jews were the Israelites of the Old Testament? Will they be brave enough to admit that, or will they think, well, it's best we carry on with what we've been saying all along? And the answer was, sadly, they just continued with what they'd actually been promoting. But that shows you that this information was starting to come out at that time, and people were, you know, were asking that question. And it is a real shame that that they didn't actually expose the Jewish heritage. And the thing is, people knew about that, but they didn't realize the implications of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they'd known that Flavius Josephus had said this, but they just hadn't thought, well, hang on a minute, that means they're Canaanites. And aren't the Canaanites the cursed people of the Old Testament?
Yeah, and that also makes the Germans in Jutland, northern Germany, the chosen people.
Yeah, well, we've got history that shows that as well, that the Germans and the other European nations are descended from the Israelites, the other 10 tribes, that then moved into Europe through the Israel Pass in the Caucasus Mountains. We've got lots of evidence for that. We'll get into more of that later on. Let's carry on with Himmler here. We've got some more from him in ideological training. He says, "I forbid every attack on Christ as a person, since such attacks or insults that Christ was a Jew are unworthy of us and are certainly historically not true." And that was in 1938 that he said that in Berlin. So it's not like, you know, he's changed his views in that time.
Yeah, that's 2 years after he left the Catholic Church. So he still felt the same way.
Well, I've got a quote here, which I'm going to have to read from a book, so bear with the rustling.
Sure.
And this is something that he said before he actually joined the NSDAP, and this is to do with the church. He wrote in his diary, "Come what may, I shall always love God, shall pray to him, and shall remain faithful to the Catholic Church, and shall defend it, even if I should be expelled from it." And didn't he have the last rites or something? Some connection he still had with the church right at the very end? What was that, Dennis?
I'm not so sure, because I was looking up on that as well. It seems they took a death mask of him, and it seems there was some real heavy bruising on his face. I think he was beaten to death. I think that's the consensus, whoever, you know, sees this mask, and not the cyanide story we were given. So sorry to say.
But did he still have a connection to the church right till the end? Did they say anything for him like they did for Hitler?
Not that I'm aware of, but again, I could, you know, I could be wrong. I mean, these things, after 5 years of Germany being closed after the war, a lot of things were hidden, a lot of things were buried and burnt, and so it's difficult to find out true information. But every now and again, you know, like the Untermeyer speech, it's thrown up, you know.
Well, we do know that he did leave the church, although he still seemed to have remained loyal to Christianity. And we've actually got, and this comes from the book, The Holy Reich, Nazi Conceptions of Christianity by Richard Steigman-Gull here that I'm quoting from. And this is actually what Hitler had to say about Himmler's new views. "Just as Hitler had no time for Rosenberg's plans to create a new mystical religion to replace clerical Christianity, so he found Himmler's dilettantish religious explorations absurd. As he told a circle of confidants, 'What nonsense. Here we have at last reached an age that has left all mysticism behind, and now he wants to start that all over again. To think that someday I may be turned into an SS saint!'" Exclamation mark there. Whereas Himmler, I mean, that is pretty much what some people try to do today, isn't it? Make him out to be a saint. Whereas Himmler attacked Charlemagne as an agent of Christianity against pagan Germanic tribes, Hitler declared killing all those Saxons was not a historical crime, as Himmler thinks. Charlemagne did a good thing in subjugating Widukind and killing the Saxons out of hand. He thereby made possible the empire of the Franks and the entry of Western culture into what is now Germany. Hitler was equally dismissive of Himmler's forays into German prehistory. "Isn't it enough that the Romans were erecting great buildings when our forefathers were still living in mud huts? Now Himmler is starting to dig up these villages of mud huts and enthusing over every potsherd and stone axe he finds." According to Albert Speer, the whole thing was beginning to assume far-fetched pseudo-religious forms. Goebbels, with Hitler, took the lead in ridiculing these dreams of Himmler's, with Himmler himself adding to the comedy by his vanity and obsessiveness. Hitler even approached Himmler himself in 1935, fully rejecting the foundation of a new religion, calling it a chimera. Rather than attack Himmler frontally, however, he took the indirect route of attacking Himmler's paganist ally Rosenberg, stating that he intended to take action against Rosenberg's mythos. So, I mean, I don't think Himmler can really have been taking this too seriously.
No.
Because it's very light-hearted mocking there, isn't it, and ridicule of him.
Yeah, just the fact that he's looking into it is enough to get, you know, Hitler's mocking.
I mean, it's also got a bit here that Himmler feared that the average SS man would be unable to distinguish between attacks on the churches and a preservation of Christ. Therefore, in a 1937 memorandum marked to all SS leaders from Standartenfuhrer upwards, Himmler instructed, "In ideological training, I forbid every attack against Christ as a person, since such attacks or insults that Christ was a Jew are unworthy of us and certainly untrue historically." He then added significantly, "I desire that SS men be convinced of the worth of our own blood and our past through knowledge of the actual history of our folk, the prehistory of our folk, the greatness and culture of our ancestors, so that they will totally root themselves in the value of the past, present and future. Not only Christ, but belief in Christ as a part of German history was to be respected in the SS. Such proclamations were not simply for public consumption. When a member of the Hitler Youth wrote to Himmler asking if he was to believe a Nazi lecturer who claimed that Jesus was a Jew, Himmler's secretary Rudolf Brandt replied, indicating that the Reichsfuhrer SS is of the conviction that Jesus was not a Jew. You must have misunderstood the speaker." So it's quite clear there what was going on. I think Hitler was against clericalism, wasn't he?
Yes, that's right, yeah. It wasn't a thing about faith.
It was about church leaders interfering in politics more than anything else.
Yeah, which was not their place.
And also changing what the Bible says. You know, ignoring what the Bible says. Yeah. What we get today when they promote sodomy, or, you know, they say, oh, well, the Jews didn't kill Jesus. It was the Romans, or the Jews weren't responsible. And that's clericalism as well. It's the priests trying to change tradition.
Yeah, it wasn't just Himmler. I think in 1936, I think it all came about. I think Reinhard Heydrich was another one who left for the same reasons. I think a couple left. But it did stress to the SS that not to follow his suit, because this wasn't about faith. It was about, you know, he's an enemy, like, of this clerical stuff.
Yeah, he was against that more than anything else. We got another quote here. "Written on every German soldier's belt buckle." Oh no, this isn't a quote. Sorry about that. "Written on every German soldier's belt buckle was the immortal words, 'Gott mit uns.'" And this is from your transcript there, Dennis. And then you've got you've got two verses here. So I look these verses up. Isaiah chapter 7, verse 14. "Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. And then you've got Matthew chapter 1, verse 23. "Behold, a virgin shall be with child and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which being interpreted is "God with us." And that's
right.
That's the words on the belt, isn't it? Gott mit uns.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, when you think about the actual word itself, Israel, that actually means man with God. Because what you've got there is...
That's been changed another way by other people as well. They say that's short for Ishtar, short for Ra, and then short for the other Egyptian god. But, you know...
That's in three different languages. No, it doesn't work with me either, because that's in three different languages. In Hebrew, what you've got is Is, which is man, and you've got Ra-El, which is God with. So you've got God with man, God mit uns, God with us, which is the same thing. Also, the Hebrew was written left to right. So God with man or man with God, that's what you've got there. So basically what they had written on their belts, it was either saying, it was either the name of Jesus Christ or it was the name of Israel, which is, you know, you can't say that's pagan.
No way.
And then you've got a German rallying cry, an expression of religious, political and ethnic single-mindedness. People are often confused with Himmler and the Ahnenerbe, a group of scholars that he gathered to study the ancient Aryans, which when translated into English means ancestral heritage and not pagan heritage. If it was pagan, it would be called Heidnischen Erbe. Now, I've heard this before. I've had people come up to me before and say, well, what about this pagan heritage that he was studying?
Yeah.
But it's not. It's just ancestral heritage.
Correct.
It's like the use of the runes. That was the old Saxon language. There wasn't anything mystical about it, about the use of it. It was just saying that that's part of our history. So we'll use these runes to show that we weren't illiterate. We were able to write back when there were Saxons. We got the same thing over here in Britain. We've got Ogham is what it's called.
And
it's like lines that are carved into the corner part of a stone, like grooves that are cut into it. And you get a lot of stones in Wales and in Ireland that have these grooves cut into them, and you can read. And what it basically shows is that we had our own form of writing at the time when the Romans were here. And it's the same with the Saxons. They had their form of writing. They had these runes back then.
Yeah, it's amazing, really, isn't it? What we don't know.
We also got all the interest in the traditions that they had. I mean, they tried to revive a lot of traditions. Midsummer's Day one that they had, and they tried to. They didn't just have the Christian traditions, but also the pre-Christian traditions, because it was all German heritage. You know, this is something that I don't think a lot of pagans really seem to get, that Christians and pagans were exactly the same people. It's not like, you know, a foreign force invaded a country and forced everybody to become Christian. The people in the country didn't change. They themselves decided that they would do things in the Christian way, which was more of a like an evolution of what they had been doing rather than, you know, a complete break with the past. The proof of that is the fact that we still have all these traditions, things like Christmas, things like Easter, you know, the angels of some of the angels were Christianized gods from the past. Oh, that shows that there wasn't a huge break with what we were doing before. It shows that there was a continuation of it.
Well, what that also shows the people who were against religion, they're saying that, look at the Catholic Church celebrating Christmas when it's pagan. And they twist it so that people start to believe that the Catholic Church was never Christian at all, which obviously is wrong.
And what it is European people celebrating a European festival. And the Europeans celebrated it, whether they were pagan or whether they were Christian, because the central part to it is that it was European. That's the thing. That's what people get mixed up with today. They think, oh, Christianity must be foreign. Christianity must come from the Jews. And that's just not true.
Well, they do say that, don't they? That's one of the favourite lines. We're not following that Jew cook. Obviously, Jesus.
When Christianity began, Judea was part of the Roman Empire, and Europe pretty much stretched all the way out over to there. What was the Middle East now? Constantinople used to be the centre of Christendom, and that's Istanbul in Turkey. So instead of just having white people like we do now in Europe, you had white people out there in the Middle East, out there in the Near East as well. You still had some all the way over there in India. The white world itself was much larger than it is today. And we had connections to that. We had trade routes. We had trade with Rome. We had trade with Jerusalem. I mean, it's written into the English Chronicle. It talks about one of the high priests in Jerusalem at the time in the Old Testament. and it links it to what's actually going on in Britain at the time, which shows you that, that we were connected to these people because they were all white, basically. We were all white people. Continuing here, the next bit that we've got here is on the SS. And it says, the Schutzstaffel was created in 1925 to give personal protection to Adolf Hitler from the communists at public rallies and events. And I'll just stop there because a lot of the time now, you will see the civic nationalists calling Antifa and calling them brown shirts and calling them fascists. And in actual fact, you know, the SS and the brown shirts were formed to stop the communists at the rallies, at the protests. So what we need now is brown shirts and an SS to protect nationalists at rallies. It's ridiculous calling communists brown shirts.
Disinformation, again.
Yeah, yeah. Heinrich Himmler joined the same year and eventually took charge of the SS in 1929. The official motto was, "My honour is my loyalty." Like the Teutonic Knights of the Middle Ages, they took a holy vow, practiced chivalry, and devoted themselves to God. These, combined with the organizational skills and the mental discipline inspired by the Jesuits, made them a formidable outfit. Did the SS practice chivalry? I was thinking it said practiced chastity there.
Oh, no,
I don't think they practiced chastity. Yeah, practiced chivalry. And then it says, during World War II, the SS fought with religious fanaticism, having the ability in the heat of battle to turn certain defeat into a victory which became legendary. Again, this is how history has been turned on its head, isn't it? Because they make SS out to be, you know, real bad guys that just were shooting at Jews from, you know, in the camps just for the fun of something to shoot and, you know, terribly undecent. And in actual fact, they were... They were trying to set a very good example. They were trying to set the best example that there was possible to the people. They were supposed to be the new aristocracy, a genuine aristocracy that was made up of the very best people, not people that had got there by bribing officials or just got there through money alone.
Himmler, when he first took over, I found out, there was about 100 SS when he became leader, and he got rid of 50 straight away because he insisted on all of the best. So 50 had to fall out.
So character was all important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you need to be, really. I mean, when you think about it, you've got, if you look at Africa, I mean, the whole of Africa couldn't do what one white man could do in as far as inventions are concerned, because they have that low IQ. It doesn't matter how many of them you've got, they're not going to be able to, invent rockets. I mean, they couldn't even invent the wheel. So
I think they're happy being like that. I think that's in the DNA. They just want to sleep in a tree all day. You know what I mean? South Africa is going the same way at this point in time. With a few decades, it won't be functioning.
Well, that's how they're meant to be. But then if you've just got a few white men of good character, they're able to do amazing things. That's all you need. So rather than having lots and lots of people that really weren't that good, that, you know, may have had drinking problems or gambling problems, or maybe they couldn't be trusted or what have you. You know, it's better to have people that are going to keep their word more than anything else. That's why it was their motto. Right. You know, you got to keeping their word is their honor. You know, a man is only as good as his word is. And once you've got people that are honorable and that you can trust, then you can start to build a good organization that's going to achieve great things.
Yeah, it's on that these days. You know, when you say, "I give you my word," and here's a handshake, I don't need, you know, any contract. That's all gone now.
That's all you used to be. That's all you used to need, wasn't it?
A handshake,
and that meant you were not gonna go back on that contract. And that goes back millennia. That does the handshake. I think it's actually Mitra that was the god of contracts and the god of the handshake. Right. Supposedly instituted the first handshake, and again that's Aryan, goes back, that must go back 3,000 years, I would have thought.
Well, just another point which came to mind as well was the Roman salute, which is banned obviously in Germany, and once you know all this about the empire, the Roman Empire. It's not surprising it's banned.
Was that part of the church as well, do you think, that salute?
Well, I'm quite sure they used that in the Holy Roman Empire, yeah.
Because you read about it in Josephus, talks about them saluting with their arms, the Romans.
Yeah, some call it a European salute, but it's actually a Roman salute, which Hitler adopted.
Must have been where it originated from. There's old paintings of it as well, isn't there, of people raising their arms like that?
That's right. At least banned. The fact that it's banned, you know, tells it all.
It's just another symptom of the anti-whiteness, isn't it? Anti-European.
Well, that and the hiding of the fact of the Christian Europe at that time.
Next, we've got Himmler leaves the church. Himmler, in 1936, left the Catholic Church, insisting that no one in the SS should follow suit. He claimed his departure was not about his faith, but that he had become anti-clerical towards the church. He remained a Christian until his death in 1945, hence the reason for his protective statement on Jesus Christ only 2 years after leaving the church. So you say there he remained a Christian until his death. That's what I was wondering, where you got, you know, what makes you think that, Dennis?
Well, the fact that, you know, he's still thinking that, you know, Jesus Christ is his God, even after he's left the church, there's nothing to show that he changed his mind since then.
And he wrote that in the diary as well, didn't he? That even if the, you know, he left the church, he would still remain a Christian and a Catholic. So I think he was probably interested in all these, you know, these pre-Christian things, the same as he was interested in Aryans all around the world and the history of Aryans all around the world. And it's the same as I'm interested in all of this, but I'm still a Christian. It doesn't make me not a Christian to be interested in, you know, the earlier white religions and what we can learn from them. It just means that you...
Well, that's right. I mean, I haven't been to church in God knows how long. I mean, and I know what the church is today, but it doesn't alter the fact, although I no longer belong to the church, I am a Christian.
And you try to obey the Christian laws. I mean, that's what all of European law is based upon, is these Christian laws.
100 years, yeah.
And when you look at, if you look at someone like Alfred the Great, and he collected the oldest laws together, and apparently the oldest laws in Britain were written in the 6th century BC by Malmutius, and he wrote down the laws that we had then. They were called the usages of the country, and they evolved into something called the triads, which was quite easy to remember. There was usually sort of three things to remember in each one. And then Alfred the Great wrote those down. And when he was writing them down, he said, you know, these are the same as the laws of the Old Testament and the Ten Commandments. And they were just sort of written in a different way. And in his introduction to it, he comments on this as well, that, you know, that the Saxons or the English, they already had these same laws that that Christians had, which shows you again this connection between the Israelites and also with the Europeans, because we had the same laws: honor your father and your mother, that your days in the land may be long. I mean, that's saying be a nationalist. It's not saying just honor your immediate mother and father, but you've got to honour all your mothers and all your fathers if you want to live a healthy life and keep the land that the Lord has given you.
I've got to say so later on. Carry on, sorry. My mind went blank.
Well, I was going to say, and you've got, you know, they don't covet after your neighbour's wife, no idolatry, one day off a week. I mean, all of that was written down in
I thought what I'm going to say now, it was the fact that people say we don't need 10 commandments to know what's right and wrong. And to a certain degree, I suppose you're right. Well, the problem comes when you get different degrees of right and wrong. Some people think what is wrong, others won't. And that's when you get the problem where people like Crowley, for instance, took it way beyond what any normal person would believe was right.
And also then you get, well, what are you saying there, that man can make up his own law?
Well, that's what they're saying.
If man can make up his own law, then who's to say that one man's law is right and another man's law is wrong, is false?
Correct.
You know, you have to have laws that come from God, really. I mean, this is the point of this. I think we understood a lot more back then that all of this could only have come from God. It could only have come from the Holy Spirit. There's nowhere else it could have come from. You know, it couldn't have been dreamt up by people back then. Now, even the idea, I mean, this was pointed out to me by Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, that, you know, when it says in the beginning there was nothing in the Bible, I mean, that was centuries before the concept of zero actually existed, before this mathematical construct of zero, of nothing, before it existed. And yet there it is in the book of Genesis, centuries before they had this concept. So that, you know, it could only have come from God through the Holy Spirit. And these laws.
Well, I would hate to live rules by the Stone Age, where, you know, if somebody fancies your wife, they're just going to come over and check them to beat you up. That's what we're heading for.
You know, even the dietary laws were incredibly sensible. And you wouldn't have known, you know, a lot of them. But they're all very, very, very sensible laws. All of it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of them were based on protecting Christianity. They didn't want servants under a certain age serving Jews and things like that. Just to protect, because they knew the danger of Christianity was in if the, like, you know, the Jews and the Muslims ever got close to overtaking them, which they obviously have done today.
Well, the church said that Jews couldn't have Christian servants. That was one of their laws, and they said that Jews couldn't marry Christians, Jews couldn't hold public office, they couldn't teach, they weren't allowed to indulge in usury for the first 1,000 years.
That's right. The Catholic Church was the only one to oppose them out of all the organisations. Can't think of one other.
Yeah, once the church split, and then you had Protestantism. None of the Protestants really fought against usury. I'm not sure what happened with the Eastern Orthodox, how strongly they fought against usury, but right up until 10, I think it was 1066, something like that, or 1060, right up until 1060, the church was united. So the Eastern Orthodox Church and what became the Roman Catholic Church and the Celtic Church, they were all just one church. It was called the Catholic Church, just one church. And then in 1060...
The Normans brought up the Jews in, didn't they, I think?
Yeah, the Normans brought the Jews in. Yeah. And that's what really sort of did it for Britain. And then in 1260, 1290, around
your
that time...
That
was when Edward I got rid of them. I had someone say the other day, wasn't he a really bad guy? I thought, well, you know, it depends how you look at it. If you look at it from Hollywood's point of view, they always portray him as a bad guy.
But if you look in, favor.
Yeah, but if you look in British history, it says that in the Chronicles of England, it says that after he got rid of the Jews, everyone in the country all paid him a penny in gratitude for doing that.
Really?
Yeah. So they were, you know, a penny must have been quite a fair old bit back then. It wasn't a tax. It was just, you know, given out of the goodness of their hearts to say thank you.
Yeah, it's just saying there's more than this. Better.
A lot more. Next up, you've got a heading here, the church and race in the Bible. Modern day apostasy in the Christian church is due to Jewish subversion of our religious institutions. And then you say the Bible is written to Adam and his descendants and is about our racial history, which it is. And then you've got laws, statutes, ordinances, and prophecy. So that's basically saying what the Bible is about, which is what a lot of people miss nowadays. They miss that that's actually it's our racial history. The laws that are in there, they're supposed to be obeyed, and the statutes and the ordinances and the prophecies that were in there, they all came true. That was the proof that this was the truth, is because these prophecies came true. I mean, it was even predicted right down to the exact time that Jesus was going to be born. There was predictions that Titus and Vespasian were going to turn up when they did. Alexander the Great fits into it as well when he went there and met the priest of the temple. When you read Flavius Josephus, you really realize just how much of this prophecy is just incredible. You know, there's no way that it could have come about by any other way than but through the Holy Spirit. So you're pointing out how important the Bible is, and then you're also saying that it's all about white people. It's about the white race. You say the word Adam means to show blood in the face. No other race can blush except for Caucasians. We got our name after we escaped Babylonian slavery and travelled north and west through the Caucasus mountain range and eventually settled in Europe. That area is still known today as the Pass of Israel. And the tribe of Judah settled in an area known as Jutland, Germany. Is it any wonder Germans are persecuted so much by the Jews? Jews know that they aren't racial Judahites, but they claim that they are, and they impersonate the true Judahites by referring to themselves as Jews. Well, there's quite a lot there. I think you summed it up pretty well in a few sentences. But Judeo-Christians will accept that the word Adam means red, and they think that it comes from the colour of the soil, but it's actually the soil was named after the red of Adam's face, basically. You can tell by the way that it's by the way that it's written. And there is no other race that can blush. And you blush with shame. You blush with shame. And again, that's tied in with Genesis. After they discover that they're naked, they blush with shame, and clothes are made for them. And, you know, I often think, well, you know, Negroes can't blush, and they don't wear clothes, so they can't be Adam, can they?
Certainly not.
And then you've got here as well about this Pass of Israel and escaping Babylonian slavery. And I'll just come up with a couple of proofs for this. When you think of who was left behind in Judea, Flavius Josephus tells us that only 10% of the tribe of Judah came back to Judea. And when you think that the whole of the tribes of Israel, there was 12 tribes. So you could say that, you know, there's another 99% of Israel didn't actually go back to Judea. If it was only 10% of the tribe of Judah and there were, you know, 12 tribes in all, I mean, it's less than 1% that actually went back to Judea. 99% of them just disappear from history. And that's a hell of a lot of people. And what we've got in Iran, there's a huge, great carving that's in a cliff face. And it tells you these captives and these captives are before the king. And it's got some writing and it's in four different languages. And it tells you who the people were that were in that area. And one of the languages calls them Iskusa. Another one of the languages calls them Gomri. And another one of the languages calls them the Hebrew. So it's basically saying that these were the Hebrews. These were the people that were put there, taken from their land, we'll call Judea for now, and were put there. And that was the 10 tribes. And the other two tribes were put in Babylon. But this lot that were put there in Iran or Assyria, the name Cymri became Cimmerians, became Cymri, which is the name for the Welsh today. The Scusa or the Saka, that was the Scythians. And the Scythians then moved into Europe. And that's why Germany used to be called Scythia, is because these original Scythians moved into Europe. And the place where they lived before, another group of people moved in there. I think there were Sarmatians and some others. So the Scythians that were in Europe making their way into Germany, the Roman and the Greek geographers, they called them Germane, meaning they were genuine, the Germane Scythians. They were the genuine Scythians. And of course that word Germane then became German. And the word Scythian.
Germanic. Yeah.
And the word Scythian itself, that became Saxon. Saxion, the way that it's written, these letters basically mean the same, can be interchangeable in different languages, certain of these letters. So basically what that saying is that and also Abiru is obviously Hebrew. So these people made their way into Northern Europe. As they made their way into Northern Europe, their names changed. And that's why the 10 tribes of the House of Israel, why they disappear from history is because they moved into Europe. And this isn't to say we didn't have other people in Europe. I mean, we still had like some people in Europe, sparsely populated. But again, these can be traced back to earlier Israelites moving into Europe by their names. There really weren't that many of them. But the largest movement came after this. I mean, one of the earliest movements was from Brutus of Troy. And Brutus of Troy, the Prince of Troy, he goes back to being a son of Judah. And that's where the name Britons come from. So Britain was settled fairly early. And of course, because it was settled fairly early, it was an important place. And that's why Caesar tells us that all the nobles and all the aristocracy of Gaul, which then became Germany, were educated in Britain. So Britain had universities, it had a road system, it had chariots. They were able to defeat the might of Rome twice when Caesar tried to have a fight with them. And the reason for this is because Britain was one of the first places that was actually settled in Northern Europe. And the other places, that they had people sort of dotted around on the on the coastlands, but not right actually inside the land itself. And again, mm-hmm. we've got historiographers that say that Europe was only occupied, only colonized really on these little coastlands. And it all makes sense because the hottest part where you had the civilization was the Fertile Crescent, which then became the Middle True. East. So you had all your civilizations there, though they're all white civilizations. Egypt and Syria, Iraq, Babylon. So
can I just say, once I started thinking on these lines of, who were the real Jews and tribe of Judah and the Canaanites and Edomites in World War II. When you think about, the rape of the German women and other Axis countries, you can see what they're trying to do, and you can see what they're trying to do again today with the influx of the Africans into Europe. It's to kill that bloodline. And they're not far from succeeding.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. There's prophecy as well. It says in the Old Testament that there will come a time when Esau has got the upper hand, and it will be the time of Jacob's trouble. And that's the time mm-hmm. that we're living in now. When Esau does have the upper hand, the Jews are in charge. They are sort of fighting back. They have gone back to the high places of the wilderness, which it says the Edomites will do. It says they will go back mm-hmm. to their former high places, and then God will destroy them and he'll turn them to ash. Mm. Because that's who the Jews are. They are descended from Esau, and Europeans are descended from Isaac, these two brothers.
Well, I think because I was listening to Bill Fink as well at one point, and he explained it pretty well as well. But what it means when the Jews substituted the words in the Bible of Judea or Judah, it elevated them to a higher level, which people believe them to be today. It's just a sleight of hand, if you like.
Yeah, they actually went to them. And again, this was when Protestantism began, really. They went to the Jews and said, help us translate the Bible. So, of course, the Jews, the rabbis, told them what they wanted to put in there, told them the translations they wanted. We went into Gentile the other week and how that's a particular one that's been changed.
Yeah.
But you're also saying about the Jews here and how they're from the Canaanites. You then say Jesus wasn't a Jew by race or by religion. He was from the tribe of Judah, the royal bloodline of Jacob Israel. The Jewish religion is known as Judaism, which is the teachings of the Babylonian Talmud, which says that Jesus is in hell for eternity. It actually says he's boiling in a cauldron full of excrement for eternity.
Yeah, I didn't really want to put that.
Yeah, it might offend some people, that.
Yeah, it offends me.
Yeah.
Can I just say as well that it's proven that the Canaanites, their descendant, you've got to be a Jew today, for instance, mother has got to be a Jew, where it was the father in the line of Judea.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right the way through the whole Bible, it's your father that is important.
Yes.
And that's the same in all European history. There's another bit as well, I would say, that the Jews can't write the word Yahweh down. They can't say the word Yahweh. They're forbidden from saying it. And when you think, when you've got a, like a bastard, he's forbidden from using his father's name because he's a bastard. He's not allowed to use that name. If you're an illegitimate, you have no claim to that name. And it just seems to make sense to me that the Jews have no claim to the word Yahweh because they're bastards. They might
have mentioned it. It's probably why they go down the mother's line. But then again, any mother can be a Jew, you know, by religion or by race.
Well, we know that, again, from Josephus, we know that at the time of Jesus, they were trying to convert as many people as they can. The Jews were, not the Christians. The Jews were. The Jews were trying to convert as many different races and peoples as they could to becoming Jews. And they were called proselytes of the gate or proselytes of justice. Whereas the Christians apostles were told to only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. They weren't told to go to all these different people. They were told to go to the nations that were promised to Abraham. The particular people. It was the Jews that were trying to convert people to Judaism. That's why you get the Khazars. Later on, the Khazars all converted to Jewry and interbred with them. And earlier than that, when you've got the tribe of Judah interbreeding with the Edomites in the first place. This idea, this was a Babylonian idea that this remnant of the tribe of Judah brought back from Babylon. Josephus tells us that they were all the dregs of society as well. They really weren't the best. And then the Bible tells us that a lot of them had strange wives, and they kicked all the strange wives out, and they kicked all the bastards out, and they tried to do things right. But only a few hundred years later, that they were interbreeding with the Edomites again, and then the Canaanites, the Edomites, just took over the whole of Judea.
As they do.
Yeah, or exactly the same as they've done today. If we paid attention to this history, we would have known. We would have expected everything that's going on today.
Exactly.
You say Jews are Edomites, Canaanites, and later they became the Khazars from Eastern Europe as they became Jews by conversion. And then you've got an example of one of the corruptions in the Bible, which is the inscription mocking Jesus above him on the cross. And it says, Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum. And people say that that means Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. But this has been wrongly translated for centuries. The correct translation being Jesus of Nazarene, ruler of the Judeans. The Judeans.
That's right.
And that's pretty important. Because the Jews of today, they're not Judeans, are they?
No.
So that's you know, making it quite clear that it's not talking about Jews. And these Jews, you know, they haven't called the land that they've gone to, they haven't called it Judea, have they? They've chosen to call it Israel, which again is, you know, they were, the actual tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin were at war with the house of Israel throughout the Old Testament. They're actually at war with them. And yet these
I think some Jews go in Judea because they have to, not racially, it's like they were brought in, you know, to be accepted, but not by race. You know, the Jews obviously were left out in the cold, and were grateful for this. And so he said, yeah, fair enough, we'll sign anything and go live in Judea. But they're not racial Judeans.
Well, they accept blacks and Chinese and all sorts, don't they?
Anybody, even me.
Into the Jews today, and yet they claim to be racial. Quite clearly not. I mean, the whole of the Old Testament is strictly racial. And the New Testament.
The most mixed race in history, and now they bring out racial laws.
Bizarre. It's like chasing the horse after the horse has bolted, isn't it? Or shutting the door after the horse has bolted. I think that's why they try and obey all these food laws and, you know, they circumcise themselves. And I think it's the same with the Arabs and the Muslims. You know, they try to be devout in all of this. Mm-hmm. There's no point because they're mixed. They're mixed race. You know, they've lost whatever it was that they originally had. So it doesn't matter how many laws they follow. They can't fix that. That's the one thing that can't be fixed.
They lie.
Well, they lie and pretend, don't they?
They close down history. No.
And then you finish off with some bits about the Roman Empire. When Germany annexed Austria in 1938, Waffen-SS soldier Major Walter Buch disguised himself and travelled ahead to Vienna. He checked into a small hotel with a Luger pistol with secret orders to defend the Holy Lance, which according to the Gospel of St. John is the lance that speared the side of Jesus as he hung on the cross, and the crown jewels. Their reputation had been formed by nearly 2,000 years of Christian mysticism and German legends, both held at the Kunsthistorisches Museum. He was ordered to kill anyone who might attempt to take them before the stormtroopers could secure the city. On March the 12th, German troops entered into Austria. It was only then that Buch changed into his SS uniform. 3 days later, on the Catholic feast day of St. Longinus, Buch removed the collection from the museum and presented them to Hitler. Major Buch raised his arm in a Roman salute and announced, "Die Heilig Lanza, mein Führer," the Holy Lance, my Führer. The Holy Lance and the Crown Jewels were escorted to Nuremberg on a heavily guarded eight-car train, arriving on August the 30th, 1938. 1 week later, they were displayed at a special opening ceremony at St. Catherine's Catholic Church. And we've talked about that a little bit before, haven't we, about
pilgrimage.
Yeah, this big pilgrimage there. I think Bishop Williamson wasn't really aware of it.
I think that was in Trier, that one. So they had a couple.
But just displaying this and putting them back in the place where they should be, you know, it's...
Yeah, the rightful home, really.
Yeah, it's like Hitler was, you know, hoping to be crowned as emperor, I think, at one point.
I think if he won the war, it would have been, yeah.
Would have been. Along with the Holy Lance and the Crown Jewels, Hitler gathered a large collection of relics from the Holy Roman Empire, which had formally ceased in 1806. These included royal slippers, gloves, stockings, vestments, and the embroidered silk coronation robe of the Holy Roman Emperor. Hitler also collected the most valuable collection of holy relics outside of the Vatican, a piece of wood from the Holy Cross, cloth from the robe worn by the Apostle John, links from a chain that shackled St. Paul, soil soaked with the blood of St. Stephen, a bone relic of St. Maurice, the patron saint of the Holy Roman Empire, and the Holy Lance, the Spear of Destiny, and the Holy Crown Jewels were then returned to Austria after World War II by General George S. Patton. So it was quite clearly a Christian enterprise.
Yeah.
Right from
That's
the start.
That's the point I was trying to make.
And this is the rebirth of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah, it's the reason why we're not told that it was a holy war, like I said, because they killed quite a number of Christians in that time and World War One, and there's still quite a lot of Christians yet to get rid of. So the quieter that story is, the better for them.
And when you think about it, I mean, we started this with his quote from Franz von Papen that they were putting into practice the principles of the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's exactly what they were doing, was reinstating Catholic tradition, Christian tradition, for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, which is why they probably used Pope Pius to the point where they didn't need him anymore, and then poisoned him, and then brought in, ever since then, a succession of Masonic popes.
Yeah, this was the last ditch attempt, wasn't it, to get things back how they should be. I mean, you had the Second Reich, which ended in 1806, but it had probably been corrupted since before then, I would have thought.
Well, I don't think many people in England even know about it. You know, they're not even taught anything near it. You know.
Well, we're very anti-Catholic, I think. Because
they said that the Catholics don't get any positions of power in Britain.
Because, you know, they needed an excuse for the king to do all the looting. Was it Henry VIII or Henry V? Because he wanted to loot all the money.
Henry VIII, yeah.
Yeah, they needed an excuse for that. But there was no real reason for it. They didn't have indulgences. They didn't have, you know, witch trials or any of these excesses and bad things that, you know, the church was supposedly accused of on the continent. We never really had that in Britain.
Well, the excuse was he wanted a divorce, in it. But I mean, I think there's more to that, because when we find it, like in this series, that Tudor line going down to Elizabeth I, and, you know, that this is when, you know, Dee and all the others with the cults. They started dabbling with the cults. Eventually, the British Empire and Freemasonry was formed to go out there and, you know, make the road easier.
Yeah, and subvert the rest of the world. Something else which we've gone into before, haven't we? All right, Dennis, well, we've gone a little bit over here. So
all right.
Thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
Radio.